Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm here talking to P.D. James about her novel, The Lighthouse. And listeners to the podcast should be warned that we are going to give away the ending. Wilkie Collins, who I know, Phyllis greatly admires and enjoys, used to make pleas at the beginning of his novels to reviewers that they wouldn't do that. And I think almost invariably reviewers of novels like To the Lighthouse quite carefully don't. But we're going to, because we presume that part of the satisfaction of the literary analysis we're going to perform is in seeing how we could have worked out but failed to. And perhaps very luckily, if I can add a personal note, my wife, who's a great fan of P.D. James's novels, quite often comes to this event, and because of an unforeseen childcare implosion, couldn't. And it's a very good thing, although it's sad for her, very good thing, because she's halfway through the novel and is wildly and wrongly, erroneously guessing as she goes along about what the solution is. It's wonderful to have Phyllis here because I'm sure to lots of you, to me, she's simply the best, writes the best and most satisfying novels of detection, I'd call them. Detective novels, crime novels, murder mysteries. And there's a special sort of, I mean, the pleasure I take in them is, I suppose, personal, but I confess, as a literary academic, it's probably an occupational one as well, because you notice that, I notice amongst my colleagues, that when self-deceivingly, they sometimes talk over lunch over how they might write a novel one day. The thing we hanker after always is to write a detective novel. And occasionally somebody really clever like Umberto Eco goes and does it. But there's a special affinity, I think, between sort of academic criticism. I won't pursue this too far, but detective fiction. And maybe it's a sort of repaying of the kind of compliment that Phyllis pays in her novels to sort of literary criticism, actually, because you'll all know that not only, I mean, they're very literary books in many ways, and not only is her favourite detective, Adam Dalgliesh, of course, a published poet, but his girlfriend is actually a literary academic, isn't she?
Yes, she is indeed, yes.
Although a sort of more interesting and genteel one than perhaps is always common, but the books are sort of studded with literary clues, and I just wondered actually if that was maybe a way into where we might start, because there's lots of things, too many things I want to ask you about, but I wondered if with this novel, if I could start by asking you a bit about the victim. He is himself a novelist, and he's a novelist who, in various ways, manipulates and sacrifices people to his craft. I think people have sometimes said that quite a lot of the victims, the first victims, anyway, of your stories, and like Nathan Oliver in this story, sort of deserve what's coming to them. And Nathan Oliver seems to fairly richly deserve what's coming to him. Do you think, for you, is that kind of quite often a satisfying part of the logic of the story?
Well, John, I don't think it is, actually. I mean, I think that the victim is a tremendously important part of the book, and we really need to know about him, and that's just one of the problems of writing detective fiction. If he's dead at the beginning, you don't know. In his voice, you don't know. If you can postpone the awful deed, then, of course, we can, at that time, enter into his mind and see what his problems and what his difficulties are. Of course, he's got to have at least one deadly enemy, or he's not going to get murdered. So mostly, the victims are rather unpleasant people. There's no getting away from that. And he is, in many ways, an unpleasant man. But when, of course, I'm writing about him, I thoroughly sympathise with him. I understand him completely. I don't mean to say I necessarily approve of him, but here he is. I think he has, I try to give the impression he is a very, very good novelist.
Yes.
There's no two ways about that. He's not all that old. I made him, I think, about 67, and yet he seems older than that, and that is not all that. I mean, for my age, it seems pretty young. But he's...
Well, he's worried about his fading powers a lot.
He's worried about his powers. He really feels that they're fading. His words are going. And he has nothing else, because you're so right. His whole life has been dedicated to this. And I was rather interested in the scene with Millie in the book, the young girl, the only one who likes him at all. And he's using Millie.
Yes.
And when Dalgliesh talked, somebody says he's only using her to find out, you know, what she's like. And Dalgliesh says, which I think is true about a novelist, he knows what she's like. He knows, but he doesn't know the words she would use when she talks. It's her conversation. It's a sort of, he is using her. So, and his daughter, you know, his daughter is very unhappy and he has no relationship with her. There is nothing but the talent. And he feels that slipping away.
And it's funny because on the one hand, he does this thing, which I suppose novelists are sometimes accused of, which is using everybody around them as their copy.
Yes.
But on the other hand, I mean, he's compared a couple of times to Henry James. In fact, his loyal editor says, he's better than Henry James, doesn't he? He says they're real profundities rather than sometimes rather pretend ones. But there's a bit, the funny thing is that the man, Mark Yelland, isn't it?
Who the scientist.
Who doesn't like him.
No.
Admires his writing. Yeah. And he cites something, now you'll have to correct me, I may have got this wrong, but he cites something that I think you've said about... books you admire and maybe even your own ambitions as a writer. We hear that quote from Henry James about to help the heart. He does
what
Henry
James...
To help
the heart of man to know itself.
Yes. So you've created this writer on the one hand.
Yes.
Does the sort of most horrible thing that a novelist might do.
Yes.
And on the other hand, he does the most admirable thing that a novelist might do.
Yes, indeed. And it is very important, and as I say, that we feel... that there is a talent there. But of course, when we think about Yelland and his dislike of him, there's that, some people say artificiality, that nearly everybody on that island has some particular reason for disliking
him. Of
course, And of course, with Yelland, he has destroyed the career of one of his young scientists by persuading him to be, you know, to tell him things about how the laboratory was run, and then using it to try and discredit the use of primates in experiments. In fact, I think that conversation at dinner between those two, when Yelland actually and Oliver the novelist confront each other, and both give a speech really, which really expresses those two different views. Which is a bit unusual in a detective story, but it just shows it's in this time. But in one way, you could say it's a little artificial, isn't it? Strange that every one of them has got something in their past. So there's quite a lot of hatred there.
Yes, but I mean that's a sort of that's
a convention.
That seems to be something you embrace. I mean,
you do. It's a convention.
Yes, and I mean you obviously in this novel, in other novels, but I mean in The Lighthouse, you clearly, the closed circle of suspects.
Exactly.
Which the characters themselves refer to. You know, we're all suspects, one of them says.
They are.
I mean, and that, obviously that's partly what readers like. But when we get to the denouement, or that's perhaps the wrong word, the revelation of most of what's happened, when you make Dalgliesh gets very topical. He gets he gets SARS.
And it is topical, isn't it?
Yes, and as he's recovering, it sort of comes to him.
Yes.
And the evidence that comes to him, or the shreds of knowledge that come to him, are sort of bits from the book, aren't they?
Absolutely.
So they're things that we...
Yes, he hears voices again, he remembers things, and they get together, like bits, as he says, I think, of wood swimming around, they suddenly clink together.
Do you always have a strong feeling that you've got to play by the rules, as it were, when you...
I think I do, John, because... I am using almost a classical form of the detective story. I'm trying to see what I can do with it. I'm trying to stretch it. Quite unashamedly, I'm trying to write a good novel. But it's very much in the tradition, started in the Golden Age or before that, of the the closed society, the group of suspects, even with means, motive, and opportunity for the crime, the detective who comes in rather like an avenging god to put everything right, and the solution at the end, which the reader should be able to arrive at by logical deduction from clues which have been inserted in the book with certain cunning, but nevertheless an essential fairness. And that is one of the rules. It's got to be fair. Mm. I mean, I really feel I think for lots of readers, I'm not sure they care very much whether they get it right or not. There's two kinds of reader. One who is really thinking, this puzzle, I will solve it. I know one who writes down all the clues. So they come. I love to see him writing down the wrong clues. And then you have others. I'm in the second group, I think. It's nice to have the puzzle there, but I just enjoy it as a novel. I'm interested in who did it, but I'm more interested in the people.
I'm
delighted to hear that.
But like your second group, I'm sort of contented.
Yes.
Never to get them. But as I read, I'm aware there are certain things which are either clues or red herrings. They've got to be one or the other.
Yes.
Because of the attention that's drawn to them. Yes. And perhaps rather incuriously, I sort of leave it at that. I notice them, but I don't sort of...
No, but you've got them tucked away here.
Yes,
absolutely.
But let me ask you about one sort of... I don't know if it is a rule you go by, but something that interested me when I was reading The Lighthouse, which is a sort of... In a way, it's both a literary critical thing...
Yes.
Which, as it were, I'd expect my students to notice if they were writing an essay about the book.
Yes.
But it's also a way that simply the plot of a good detective novel might work. And that is to do with whose head we're in, I suppose. I'll put it very crudely. The actual murderer is somebody in whose head we do not go. There are some characters whose point of view we get.
Yeah.
And there are some characters whose point of view we don't get. So... I think I'm writing, saying, for instance, we get Guy Staveley, the doctor, we get a bit inside him, but we never get inside his wife's head.
No.
And when I was reading, I found myself noticing that and thinking, is this steering me somewhere? Is this not related to the possible culprit?
Yeah.
I mean, in an extreme case with... Rupert Maycroft.
Yes.
There's so much in his head that I started thinking, it can't be him. It can't be him. Because we're feeling his shock after the murder.
Yes.
How could we feel that and find out him? Is this a false...
No, you're being very intelligent, of course, aren't you? Yes. And actually, this points to a real problem. It always has been a problem. Dorothy L. Sayers wrote that the detective story could never be really good literature because you never could deal with one of the most important characters, the murderer. You couldn't enter into his mind, you couldn't enter into his thoughts, his compulsions, nothing at all, because, you didn't know who he was, then he's dead, and you can't do that. And there are ways round this. For example, one way is that if it's going to be an impulsive murder, then you can get into the murderer's mind and his dislike and his hatred and his problems because he hasn't planned it. But once he's planned it, to get into his mind is not playing fair with the author. So one clever way, as you've done, is to say, whose mind haven't we got in?
Yes. Yes,
let's cut down life.
Well, I did rather do that.
Yeah, naughty, yeah. Makes life very difficult for the detective novelist. But actually, it is a problem.
There's some people, aren't there, who write detective novels where we only get the detective's point of view.
Exactly, yes.
So
or the Watson's point of view.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
You like to do...
I think it adds richness to the book to get into the minds of the different characters and see events. And not only that, you can occasionally demonstrate how subjective our experience is. One book, which is set in the psychiatric, I think it's called A Mind to Murder.
Oh, yes, yes.
There, for example, the victim is lying dead and they send for the psychiatrist who disliked her very much. And he's a man who has this awful nervous habit that when he's really shocked, he laughs, he giggles. It's a terrible embarrassment. And this happens, so it's all down in the basement record room, and there are all these files of the record. And he turns away and clutches at the end of them and just controls himself. And then when the sister, who's also there, goes home at night to the woman with whom she shares a house. She said, how extraordinary with Dr. Snyder, because I always thought he disliked Miss Bolam. But he was so upset, you know. He was weeping. And we don't see things in the same way. And if you are in different minds, you can see that, which I think is interesting. But also, I like to get in the district of minds. I want to know a lot about them. About their past, I don't know what they're feeling now.
Yes,
but that is a difficulty.
Have you ever had a conscious? Are you conscious of ever having a murderer whose point of view we did see before we found out that it was him or her?
Not once when we're in his mind. Once the murder has been planned.
No,
but I have had murders who have not planned the murder.
Yes. So we get their point of view
before.
So
we get all their point of view before. And that of course, is fair and reasonable.
Yes.
But, and also, you see, once the murder's taken place, it's difficult. Because if you go into the mind of the murderer then, the reader will sort of feel, well, once he's committed this murder, the murder would be in his mind the whole time. And therefore, you don't go into the mind of the murderer afterwards. I never have, because I feel that that's, you know, what would he be thinking about, except whether he's going to be discovered and whether it's going to be. But I've sometimes thought that's a little restricting, because presumably he can wake up early in the morning and something else could be in his mind for a time. But I don't think it would work. So it's not only, you know, whether you're in his mind before the murder, it's whose mind are we in after the murder?
Well, but I mean, I feel that in a way, a really sophisticated writer of detective novels like yourself, in a way, it has to be stricter about the rules of human psychology than. Because other kinds of novelists will, I mean, have characters into whose mind you're allowed access. But you're not told something really, really important about them.
Absolutely. No,
but that happens all the time.
No, I think that's wrong, don't you?
Well, but I mean, it's a sort of... But you could say, couldn't you? You could say, I don't know, Pip narrates Great Expectations.
Yes.
And he never says, and that Magwitch, he turned out to be my dad. You know? I mean, he never does. He keeps back all the revelations, doesn't he? But as he's telling you all the earlier chapters, he knows.
Yes, he knows, doesn't he?
He knows.
Absolutely.
And we sort of, I don't think we think that's unfair, do we?
Oh, no, we don't think that's unfair. No, I think I was probably thinking rather naturally the detective story when I think it could be unfair. No, I think that's the convention of the novel generally.
Yes.
He is the narrator.
And what about the sort of...
we would hate John to have this sort of thing in that kind of novel. Little did I know at the time. Yeah. You know, that's always maddening in a novel.
But, well, yes, except that Dickens does that as well. You know?
he does everything.
Yeah, yeah. Thinking about the thing you mentioned right at the beginning, which you like, the confined space.
Yes.
And obviously there is some sort of... there's some good formal reasons why that helps form the plot of a detective novel. But I wonder, you do also choose... I wonder whether there's something rather English, in a way, about your choice of the settings and the confined location. I mean, are you consciously thinking, I'm going to present a little microcosm here or something? That you like these... I mean, this isn't about an institution exactly, but it almost is, isn't it?
Yes, oh, it is.
And you get the representatives of different classes.
Yeah, I think that's rather part of the attraction of the genre, because you have these people, and they usually are in an institution or a place, and unwillingly, in some cases, there they are living and working together. And you do examine it like a little microcosm of the wider world outside, and it can, in fact, be that. And even in the Loud House, with the preoccupations, are the preoccupations of people in the wider world outside, with nearly all of them. I mean, and the interesting thing is that the staff are, in fact, all trying to escape from something, aren't they?
Yes.
It is the thing. Not the people who come, the VIPs. They're trying to sort of somehow rest and look at their lives and see if they can sort of renew their energy and enthusiasm. But the rest of them are, in fact, escaping.
Yes.
The doctor, because he feels responsible, he doesn't want the responsibility of doing a proper doctoring job. And the priest, because he's an alcoholic.
So they've all got these backstories.
They've all got those backstories, which means why they're there. And in fact, one can study them, really, rather like ants, and see them scurrying around with their little preoccupations.
I mean, it seemed just very peculiarly English. There's all these rules about the trust Absolutely. Who's allowed to live there? I mean, it seems fantastically sort of a sort of characteristic British thing.
Well, it is very British, but also it was very necessary for the plot.
Yes.
Because, you see, two things. I've got to have an excuse for Dal Grease being called in, because he's a metropolitan police detective and he has no jurisdiction normally outside. And secondly, I don't want too many visitors there. There'd be too many people to cope with. And yet, obviously, there must be far more than two visitors there. So there's the idea that there's going to be a big, well, not big necessarily, but a very, very secret international conference. And, of course, the island would be absolutely wonderful. It would be secure. And therefore, the Foreign Office on 10 Downing Street has said, you know, don't take any more visitors after these two. And that means, and then, of course, because they want it quickly solved, I can solve both those problems. There's an excuse for Dal Grease being called in, rather than the local police. And I've only got a limited number of suspects to cope with.
It's a wonderful convention of all satisfying detective fiction that the poor old local police always get. I mean, it's even though in the Moonstone, isn't it? Man's brought up by a local police bumble along.
That's very English, certainly, yes. Isn't it? But also what is very English is that it's very rare for them to be in any way corrupt.
Yes.
You know, they may be ill-educated. I mean, there's that wonderful superintendent in the Dorothy L. Sayers one about the honeymoon one, Dad Busman's honeymoon.
No, I haven't read that one.
Well, it's terribly funny because there is a... Whimsy goes off with his bride to this house for their honeymoon in the country. And, of course, the previous owner is found dead in the cellar. So this wonderful superintendent comes in. And most of the time when they're discussing the case together, they're exchanging sort of, you know, quotations from the Oxford Book of English. The chap can't speak grammatical English because he's spared all this up. Nobody, of course, does anything so awful as take anybody's fingerprints. And as far as I can see, the autopsy was done on the kitchen table, but there we are. I don't know what I'm telling you now. Where have I gone? What are we talking about?
We were talking about the sort of peculiar Englishness of these sort of places.
Well, that's a very English thing, isn't it? I mean, if you look at the Hard Boys School of America, their policemen were absolutely violent and ruthless and
well, isn't it also a sort of thing that other kinds of novelists who don't write detective fiction are interested in, of a sort of, it's great to have codes of propriety and refinement beneath which everybody's seething with resentment and passion. And
It's the contrast.
Yes.
And that's one contrast, the contrast between what is going on in people inside and the sort of exteriors they present to the world. And also very much also in the setting very often. I mean, Auden said that he could really only enjoy, and he loved detective stories, but he could only enjoy them if they were set in a village or a small town. It had to be the great good place.
Yes.
And the murder had to take place in a setting which provided the contrast. You know, he didn't want Raymond Chandler's mean streets. And, of course, we're on a beautiful island. There it is.
Yes. Ooh. Yeah, you like beautiful places as well.
In my
bad
novels, I do like bad things happen in beautiful places.
I always get his quotation wrong and then somebody berates me about it. But isn't there I think it's in Norfolk that Holmes and Watson are going to some case.
Oh,
and
yes,
Watson
absolutely.
Says, isn't it lovely?
Yeah,
and Holmes says something like, there lurks more human evil within a mile of us than in the worst sewers of Limehouse.
Absolutely does.
Can I ask you about some clues about, because we're talking about earlier, because you must, this is something I presume, you know, you must be conscious of. There's certain clues, which I said earlier, well, I know that's either a clue or a red herring.
Yes.
And one of the, because the sort of, the light shines on it. And I wonder if you can remember how consciously you did this in this novel, that there's, for instance, there's something people say sometimes. I think they say it in about five times in this novel. Yeah. A character says, well, it was rather odd.
Yes.
And odd is like a P.D. James, you know, the electric current is flowing at that point.
Yes.
And, well, it's true, isn't it? You do say, but sometimes, so you swing the attention on something, and two of the things which are described as odd, one of them is crucially important to the murder, and the other is sort of a red herring. One is the blood supposedly being dropped overboard, and the other is the ashes in the great.
Yes.
And these things, I think, are both described by one character or another as odd two or three times.
Absolutely. I think it was the cook to begin with when Kate and Benton were talking to her, and she was talking about Dan. Yes.
So are you very, you're giving a tweak there.
Well, I'm giving a tweak, but I hope it wouldn't be too noticeable, but nevertheless, it is a tweak. And there have to be clues.
Yes.
See, there have to be clues. It's got to be fair, hasn't it?
It's absolutely fair, but it's also slightly, perhaps mischievous is saying going too far, but there's the possibility that it's not a clue as well as that.
There's always a possibility it's not a clue. But it's interesting, really, that the poor victim who's murdered is the only one who's speaking the truth.
Yeah.
Because he says he did it on purpose. And everybody thinks, that's you
yes,
being malicious
yes, yes,
again.
Yes, yes,
of course he didn't do it on purpose, poor boy. You know, he's desperately worried about it. He expects to get the sack.
Yes.
It's all awful. But, of course, exactly what he did.
Yes. But there's another, I mean, obviously part of the pleasure of it is Red Herring. So there's another thing you do sometimes, I think, not just in this novel, but you do it definitely in The Lighthouse, where you actually have the detective who, by the standard of detectives in current detective fiction, is a very reliable one. I mean, Dalgliesh, he does occasionally, I don't think he makes any mistakes exactly in this one. I know he occasionally makes mistakes, small, he has hunches which are proved to be wrong occasionally in some of the novels. But as detectives go, he's pretty reliable. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit where Mrs.
Is it the cook or the housekeeper?
Yes, I can't remember whether she's the cook or the housekeeper. You'll be able to.
I'm delighted to hear that.
And she gives an account, and at the end of her account, which has got lots of things in it, the narrative says within Dalgliesh's thoughts, he was sure she'd said something of crucial importance, and he starts going through it.
Yes.
And I was going, oh, God, and I started turning back.
I know.
And you do this, and it is part of the pleasure of it. It's not a complaint I'm making, au contraire. But you do this thing that she has said, I think I've got this right, she has said something that in going back over her account, he appears not to have noticed, which she said something about how Jago's sister was raped and hanged herself.
That's it.
And you've got this word hanged.
Yes.
And when he goes back, oh, there's something in what, and you think, you're not noticing it. And I was convinced that at that point you did me.
Yes.
Because I was convinced at that point.
Especially as the victim was hanged.
Yes.
Yes.
So I made that connection.
Yes.
And I thought, you're not making the connection. Yes. So it must. But of course, actually, he has heard something that's crucial. But it's sort of three paragraphs further back.
Absolutely.
About the why the mother and son might have first come
exactly
to the island and when they came.
Yes, when they came.
Yes.
But of
so
course,
you must have thought,
that clue.
I'll get a few academics who'll tumble into that one.
Well, I hope they would, I must say. Especially distinguished ones like you. They don't tumble much into things. But the clues have to arise naturally from the narrative. For example, it would be very unlikely that she would suddenly say to a perfect stranger that Jago had this beloved sister this happened to. But it's attached with Millie. Why did Jago take pity on Millie when she was starving in Pentworthy and persuade her to bring her onto the island? That needs explaining. Well, because he's a kind man, but actually she probably reminded him of her sister.
Yes, yes, yes.
And therefore it's natural that she should confide that particular story.
Yes.
It makes it seem more natural and more realistic and less sort of stuck out there saying, look, I have a clue, me down.
But that's what, I mean, that's again what I think, I mean, again, perhaps a number of reasons academic critics love good detective fiction. That seems to sort of be playing fair by something that
absolutely,
but novels should do generally. You know, like, I know that your favourite, it's a taste I share, your favourite novelist is Jane Austen. And, you know, I'm pretty much invariably, if somebody in Jane Austen says or does something, there's that you can work out the reason for
absolutely
it.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think Emma is one of the finest detective stories in the language. And I can think of eight super clues.
Yes.
You know, which are there for us all to see about the truth of the relationships.
Yes.
And it's done with huge subtlety.
Yes.
Very clever. If she were alive today, she'd be a real
competition
for me.
There is actually, I can't remember, I can't remember who wrote it, but there is actually a rather a brilliant little essay by a well-known academic, whose name I've forgotten, called Emma as Detective Novel.
But you know, I wrote one called Emma as a Detective.
Oh, did you?
It's in the...
Oh, well, I think it's is it that one?
It's at the end of my... I'm so glad you thought it was good.
Yes.
I think it must be like... Oh, it's at the end of that book I did on...
This is what's called... This is what Emma would call a happy blunder.
Well, I liked it. I distinguished academic things.
Happy blunder.
But actually, I did it... I wrote a sort of part biography, part diary,
yes.
called Time to Be in Earnest. And at the end of it, I was rather fond of that essay. Yeah.
So you put it in again?
I put it in the bottom, the back of the book, yes.
Okay, well, I mean, I agree, d'accord.
Maybe another, but I think it's...
But she gets all the clues wrong, doesn't she? She sort of sees clues, yes, but anyway.
Well, it's brilliant, really.
Yes,
it's a brilliant
detective story. It's absolutely brilliant. Well, there's one more thing that I wanted to ask you about before I throw it open, and that is something I actually wrote one of the columns I wrote about the novel about, which is, what's the sex in the novel? Which which seems to be it's quite a driving force, and you actually tell us quite a lot about the love lives of the detectives, which for the mystery we don't necessarily need to know, but it's an important sort of element of the book.
Yes,
and I mean, I wonder if you think that is quite often. You know, I think George Orwell in the essay on the Decline of the English Murder that you quote in the novel. Says how very often sex is actually one of the most important ingredients of the classic detective story, which he's lamenting the decline of. I mean, do you think that's true?
I'm not sure that I do think it's true. I think on the whole, the detective story, the classical detective stories, tended to be rather wary of sex and indeed of love. I think it's in my books because it's so much part of people's lives. I mean, here we have this young Benton Smith, who is an extremely, the whole point about Benton Smith, he's half Indian and he's extremely good looking. And the point is, I think my readers think, well, what about his girlfriend? Surely he's got a girlfriend somewhere. And you feel when he's on the island, he's left his girlfriend behind.
Yes.
And we find this little actress that he's tied up with, and the fact that he cooks her all these meals and so forth and so on. And of course, Dalgliesh's love life is important. And for years it wasn't. I mean, I just assumed he had a sexual life, but it wasn't any concern of mine. And so I just didn't get on with it. But I felt it was time, this sort of icicle in his heart was melted by a love affair. So, of course, I provided Emma for him. And, of course, then we have... it's important in a book, I think, that Kate, we obviously believe... I wouldn't say she's in love with Dalgliesh, but she loves Dalgliesh.
Mm.
She really loves him. And she knows it's all hopeless, absolutely hopeless. And he has towards her that respect, rather paternal. He treats her quite differently from the way he treats Benton. So all that is part of making these people real to the reader. There's a little group of them, and their relationship to me is fascinating. The way in which Benton, you know, is very wary about this woman he's under. And Kate has always got this academic chip on her shoulder slightly, which she's trying to get rid of. That Dalgliesh nearly always has subordinates who are Oxbridge and bright. And she's always aware that she left school for comprehensive. And she doesn't realise, you know, she's a jolly good detective and everybody respects her. There was a feeling that there's a world that they know which she doesn't.
Yeah.
A whole world of words and references which just never opened.
Well, she's very impatient. Actually, the thing we're talking about, point of view, Benton says something about...
Yes.
I mean, it's wonderfully sort of wheels within wheels because Nathan Oliver sort of encodes his...
Yes.
The bad things he's done within one of his own novels, doesn't
he?
And and Benton goes off into a celebration of its brilliant use of different points of view, and she's sort of cut out by literary criticism. But actually, in a way, he's right, because the literary criticism in this novel is a sort of will lead you to the right answer, won't it, in a way?
Well, it will in a way, yeah.
Because he says that sort of that thing that Millie quotes that...
And that was, another country and the wench is dead.
The wench is dead.
Yes.
And I suppose, talking about the sex in the novel, I think that the one... I had no idea what the solution was going to be until it came. However, I became convinced quite early on that it was to do with sex, I suppose. That the solution, which it is...
Yes, indeed it is.
And I started thinking...
Sex and unhappiness.
Yes.
Childhood unhappiness and...
And I did sort of discern, because of your interest in the sexual frustrations or passions fears of the characters, and because that seemed to spread to all of them, I think I thought, it can't be the Second World War plot. That can't be the explanation.
No, you're quite right there. Yeah, absolutely right. It wasn't that. A normal sort of Kosciuszko. But I wanted to climb down the cliff.
Yes.
To be very exciting. And it's only exciting if the reader feels, you know, Benton can be climbing with a murderer.
Yes.
And putting his life into the hands of a murderer.
Yes. Well, I did. Once he'd finished the climb,
He
was belatedly crossed off my list of suspects.
Yes, and rightly, Dalgliesh said that.
Yes.
You know, they were narrowing it.
Yes.
They were narrowing it.
But before that, he had these mysterious things he used to, these mysterious liaisons on the mainland, which, you see, made me think that he was.
Yes, maybe he was.
Maybe he was. But anyway, my blunderings, enough of them. Anybody here who would like to display their ingenuity or ask Phyllis a question? Yes, the lady at the front.
What's it like for you, or do you actually watch a television representation of one of your novels or not?
Yes, with some initial reluctance. What I do enjoy is having a day watching them do it, because I love watching people at work in something that's new to me, and that's quite fascinating, watching the craft of it. But I never find that fear for one moment that the Dalgliesh is anything like my Dalgliesh. Not at all. Never. However good the actor is.
Yeah.
But I don't feel that about other people's work. For example, with Ruth, I always feel that the one she's got is exactly where
Inspector Wexford.
Absolutely, and he's brilliant. And so, and I think Ruth feels he is too. But no, it's always somehow different, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know who I would want to play Dalgliesh.
Yeah.
But with other ones, I mean, I think with Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, I think Guinness is absolutely smiling. I mean, it's brilliant, isn't it? Absolutely.
But then one thing that adaptation did, which perhaps usually adaptations of detective fiction don't do, is, I mean, it gave it a huge amount of time. So you did get pretty much all the plot.
You got all the plot and pretty much the dialogue, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
From that brilliant beginning, you know, when they're in a commission, they come in with the tea, and Watson comes in with his tea very carefully.
Yes, balancing, yes.
Within about 10 minutes, you know the different characters who are around that table. Yes. I thought it was brilliantly done.
Because the ones, the Kurt Wallander ones, which have you? I don't know if you've read any of those.
No, I haven't read them, but I saw the first one on television.
Well, if you've read them on television, to me, they're terribly disappointing, because they're very well acted, beautifully filmed, but they compress.
I know.
Totally. Some quite satisfying plots into, prostitute traffickers are jumping out of cupboards and everything is being resolved incredibly rapidly.
It's totally wrong. And they have to do that because television is so expensive now. When they first did mine, they had 5 episodes and it was very close to the book. But now you're lucky if you get 2. That's because they'll be sold overseas and, you know, they've just got to be like that. And everything is compressed.
Yes, the lady there.
What about real-life detectives? In your past work, you worked with detectives, or you worked in the police force, but do you know many real detectives today? And are they at all like your characters?
Well, I met them mostly in committees, and they were at probably rather senior level committees to discuss setting up of scenes of crime officers and so on like that, the Home Office. You don't actually meet them on the job, really. I have met them when I've been to the training schools, the detective training schools. And when I've needed information, I meet them. And they're very good and very helpful and really quite varied people. I remember some of the committees, because I don't think most people knew who I was at the Home Office. I mean, most senior people did, but, you know, it wasn't advertised that I wrote. And we'd be at some of these meetings, and I'd sometimes be tempted to say, well, all I can say is it wouldn't do for Adam Dalgliesh.
One maybe difference, which is part of the genre you're writing in, is that from the outside it looks as though in the investigation of crime in general, but murder in particular, is terrifically reliant on you know, painstaking, technological.
Absolutely.
Whereas in your books, it's a psychological and intellectual exercise, isn't it, largely?
Much more, but you do have to remember about these other things. And if you don't want soccers all over the place, you know, you have to. There has to be a reason why they're not there.
Yes.
Which in this case, of course, was because they couldn't get on the island because of the infection.
Yes.
So Kate, by that time, has taken over, and she sort of says, well, I wish there were the old days when we could take a few fingerprints ourselves instead of having all these experts. But there have been so many huge scientific developments. I mean, even, you know, DNA. Things are revolutionized.
Well, that's sort of at the heart of this one, actually, DNA, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Yeah. The thing that they, and when you go, I go sometimes, when I go to the laboratory, you know, to find out about things, they're always demonstrating some new wonder. The sort of a camera, for example, which if you have a very bloody murder and you've got red flowers all over the wallpaper and blood is straight, you want to see exactly the pattern of the blood. This camera will do nothing else but actually photograph the blood against a sort of pale background. All sorts of extraordinary things they've got. And they had one in which the policeman demonstrated to me. He said the weekends he went sailing. He used to sail around the Isle of Wight. And you have to go, when you sail around in a competition, you have to go by different boys. And he said, I always write the boys on my forearm here so that I get them right. And I haven't been there for a fortnight, and I've bathed over and over and over again. And they got the camera and photographed it. And they've got all sorts of sort of neat little dodges. But very often real investigation depends on the people who go flogging from door to door, asking the right questions, understanding about human beings. Mm. And I think that it's pretty we don't have more women detectives, because men seem to be very easily deceived when a woman is lying to them. However, I'm thinking of real life crime.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, a question at the back.
I'd like to ask you about the relationship of detective fiction to what we would call literary fiction, and whether you sometimes feel that you're disparaged, detective fiction is disparaged, and what the relationship is.
Yes, I heard this very clearly, whether I feel that... well, I don't think in this country, at its best, it is. It may be in other countries, and it certainly... There has always been, underneath this slight disparagement, it, interestingly enough, started in Victorian age, when the Victorians made a great distinction between what they called sensation, novels of sensation, and novels of realism. And because the Smith's bookstore were now selling all sorts of sensational novels, there was a great sort of amount of criticism of people saying, this is dreadful, this is dreadful, and these people are not really writing novels at all. And that's, there's still been that slight feeling. I think it's pretty well dead, frankly. I don't think a detective writer will ever win the Booker. But then the Booker hasn't got
it. But that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Why do you...
Well, they're a book of books, and not a book of books.
But that's not good, is it? If that's the case, that there's, you know, in order to win that sort of prize, you think...
No, I mean, there are. Ruth has some Barbara Vine books, which I sort of thought might well have been on the shortest of the Booker, but they're not going to be. Both Ruth and I have been Booker judges, which suggests we are regarded as reasonably serious novelists. And I have acquired, I think it's 6, doctorate of literature or doctorate of letters, which suggests that some ill misjudging university somewhere have sort of felt that that's right. And I had a great deal of critical praise. So I think it's dying away, but it's still there to an extent, I think. And I suppose if you look over the whole field of detective writing, I think especially in America, where it's incredibly popular, there must be books that would not have seen the light of day if they hadn't been mysteries, as the Americans say. I'm sure that must be so. And the same thing, there must be romantic fiction which would never see the light of day. But you can't actually... I don't think you can make a judgment about a genre, really. Because the argument I make, and I feel very strongly it interests me, is that we have in Jane Austen a writer who has the same plot, book after book. It is about a worthy, intelligent, and good girl who surmounts all sorts of difficulties to get the man of her choice. who's where they are at the end of the book. They're all Mills and Boone written by a genius. So, you know, it shouldn't be genre. It should be the quality of the writing, the quality of the understanding of human nature. And certainly for me, and I'm so glad you like it, I judge men by whether they like Jane Austen. You know, one of our greatest novelists. And she was a genre novelist. They are love stories, that's what they are. So, yes, it still exists, but I can't say it worries me at all. I did write two books that were not detective stories, and they were much easier to do than the detective story is, I must say. But and I never felt that I ought to somehow rise to something better. I've never felt that.
But it would definitely, wouldn't it, as if 1 year there was a novel by you or by Ruth Rendell or by Ian Rankin or something on even a book along list, I suspect, yes. It would definitely, that would be a story.
Yes,
I mean, it would be sort of reported as being,
Yes.
And people would have earnest discussions on the Today programme about
Indeed,
it, wouldn't
they?
Would
they
would. They definitely would.
But I wondered on about Le Carré, you see.
Yes.
I have a feeling that he says he doesn't want his books to be considered. But even if he hadn't said that, I mean, would we ever get a Le Carré on the Booker shortlist? I don't think so. No.
No, well, maybe not, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, the spy, books like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spire are good enough, aren't they? Good enough, I would have thought.
Absolutely good enough. Absolutely good enough, yes.
Yeah, maybe it's also something to do with kind of a sort of a down literary judges sometimes not having, placing a high enough value on plot as one of the key skills.
Yes, I agree there. Because if we look at the canon of English literature, our greatest novelists have always been in the business of telling a story. I mean, Dickens, of course, superbly. And really, the extraordinary way in which, in recent years, I think this is changing, the most highly regarded novelists did not tell a story. They were, you know, it was all to do with, I don't know, adultery and NW3. But I think the story is coming back. I think we need stories. We do need stories.
Well, have we got one more question to bring the curtain down before we release Phyllis to sign some books, if that's what you like? Is there anybody else who'd like to ask a question? Are you sated?
I'm very glad to be not to be faced with those awkward ones. There's something very strange on page 149, which doesn't really tie up with on page 162.
I told her that the readers of Canterbury Guardian Book Club are fantastic swats and face novelists with, I won't name name, but we have had novelists who flinched at the close textual analysis. This has gone on. But
I can't quite understand why you're facing this.
I think you've passed the test of knowledge of your own book, actually.